So we're back in James chapter 4. And just to recap, the book of James, the big idea is wholehearted devotion to Jesus. James recognizes that all of God's family, wherever they are in the world, are going to be experiencing these inconsistencies in their character, these cracks in their, these inconsistencies in their life, these cracks in their character. James is one by one highlighting each of these inconsistencies and showing us our areas of weakness, not just to make us feel guilty, but so that we would become more like Jesus. It's really interesting that in a whole book of the Bible, Jesus is only actually mentioned twice by name. And yet, the whole thing is so Christ-centered because pretty much everything James says is a reflection of Jesus' teaching from the Sermon on the Mount, mostly, but also all sorts of other places. It's a wonderfully Christ-centered book. He doesn't want to just make us feel guilty. He wants us to ask for forgiveness and for the power to change. Now, the thing about the book of James is that it's a little bit about stepping into a boxing ring. It's a very uncomfortable read in one way. He's constantly jabbing at these inconsistencies and cracks in our character. And I don't know if you've ever done any boxing. I've done a little bit of karate. It's not quite the same. I wasn't very good. I do, though, have at home a silver medal for the Welsh Team Karate Championships for my age group, which initially sounds quite impressive, but isn't really, because only two teams entered. I should probably leave the second half of that story out. I wasn't very good. There was one particular training session where I was feeling quite full of myself, and I decided I'd challenge one of the black belts to a fight. So I get ready in my best stance, and I'm looking at him right in the eye, and I swear to you, I did not see him move. I don't think he even moved a muscle, and yet I got hit by the most unbelievable punch. I was stunned. I thought someone else had hit me, but it was him. It wasn't anyone else, and there was only one thing I could do. Fell to my knees, totally dazed, not able to continue the fight. That's what happens when you get hit by a really good punch. You go straight down to your knees. And that's what James does in this passage here. He's been jabbing away at all these different inconsistencies, but really he's just been winding up for this one big knockout punch. This is his best punch that brings us to our knees. We see in the surrounding verses, verses 1 to 3, it's another jab. Again, trying to get to the root of where these quarrels, these inconsistencies in their character get to. But it all reaches this climax in verses 4 to 10, where we're going to be spending most of our time this evening. James's knockout punch that puts us on our knees. So what's this knockout punch? Friendship with the world. Verses 4 to 5, I'll read again. You adulterous people, you know that friendship with the world means enmity against God. Therefore, anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Or do you think that Scripture says without reason that he jealously longs for the Spirit he has caused to dwell in us? James is writing to half-hearted Christians. Christians who aren't whole. Christians who aren't wholeheartedly following Jesus. Sure, they might love God, but they also love the world. And all the way through the book, he's been pointing out these different flaws. Flaws in the way they treat outsiders. Flaws in the way they show favoritism. Flaws in the way they approach the struggles of life. Flaws in the way they speak. Flaws in their faith, even. And it all comes down to this. They think like the world thinks. They want what the world wants, and they love what the world loves. That's what it means to be a friend of the world, to think like want what the world wants and to love what the world loves. It's so easy to get the wrong idea about friendship with the world, to get a mixed up view of what it is to be worldly. Those two terms are pretty much synonymous. Many of us kind of get this idea of being a friend of the world or being worldly is kind of about the clothes we wear or the sort of TV programs we watch or the places we go. We try and draw a line down the whole of life and say, well, this is a worldly activity and this is a godly activity. You know, maybe it's, okay, nightclubs, clearly a worldly place. Oh, church building, however, that's a godly place. Or we do it with clothes and say that, I don't know what's fashionable anymore, but I'm going to say skinny jeans. Definitely a worldly sort of clothing, whereas Sunday best, oh, that's a godly sort of clothing. And we try and make these divisions. We can do it with workplace as well. If you work in a bank, that's no good. That is a worldly place to work. Whereas if you work in a school or a hospital, that's a godly place to work. That is good for Christians. We try and make this division, but so often that is not right at all. Worldliness, being a friend of the world, goes so much deeper than that. It goes beneath the surface. Let me give you a couple of examples to show this. You're not necessarily a friend of the world just because you watch TV. However, you might be a friend of the world if you watch TV as your primary route of escape from the trials of life. So if you've had a difficult day at work and your first thought when you get home is, oh, I just can't cope with how my life is going at the moment. I'm going to escape into my favorite TV series. That might well mean that you're a friend of the world because your first route of escape is not God, it's TV. That's thinking like the world thinks. Another example, you're not necessarily a friend of the world just because you've got a nice house, just because you live in Lisvain or somewhere posh in Cardiff. But you might be a friend of the world if all of your thought is taken up with this idea of your home. You're always thinking about the next extension you're going to get. You're always thinking about getting your lawn just right, thinking about redecorating all the time. If it's taking up so much of your thought, you just want that perfect home, then you're a friend of the world because you're wanting what the world wants. Friendship with the world goes beneath the surface. It's about thinking like the world thinks, wanting what the world wants, and loving what the world loves. And sadly, when we consider worldliness in this way, it becomes apparent that you can do all the right churchy stuff and yet be a total friend of the world in all of it. For example, you could be going to a church building, wanting and thinking in exactly the same way as someone who's going to a nightclub. We can go to church wanting to be entertained, go to church wanting to feel a buzz, going to church just wanting to meet my friends and hang out socially. That is thinking in exactly the same way as someone who's going to a nightclub. And we can wear Sunday best and yet be wearing it in such a way that is exactly like someone who's wearing skinny jeans or whatever the latest fashion is. We can be wearing Sunday best and thinking, oh, I wouldn't dare go out in anything other than 100% my best. It has to be new. I wonder what such and such is thinking about what I'm wearing. Taken up with that same exact thought process as someone who's wearing skinny jeans over here. And it works the same with jobs. I mean, of course, being a banker is not more worldly than being a nurse or a teacher, because a nurse or a teacher can be just as much taken up with, I'm going to climb that career ladder. I'm going to have that selfish ambition that we read about in chapter 3. I must get to the top of my profession, even if it means crushing everyone else beneath my feet. Being a friend of the world is not as simple as making that division. It goes beneath the surface. But really, does it matter? I mean, honestly, is it such a big deal? Can't we kind of love God and love the world just a little bit on the side? I mean, why does God care? As long as we are doing the right things, as long as we do love God, does it really matter if we're loving the world as well? Can't we have both? Let me use this example. It's Saturday after a long, hard week of work. And my wife, Mel, and I were both tired. And yet, Mel, being the lovely, servant-hearted woman that she is, she gets up early and makes me my favorite breakfast. She makes me smoked salmon and cream cheese bagels. Delicious, fantastic. And we sit down together, and we eat our breakfast, and we're having a conversation. And I say to my wife, Mel, you know I love you, dear, and I still want to be married to you, but I also want to see someone else. There's another woman, and I think I want to be in love with her as well and still stay married to you. How's Mel going to respond to that? That is a horrible, horrendous thing to say. Mel is going to be so hurt that I would even think for a second of something like that. It's disgusting, it's evil, it's wrong, it's disloyal. And if you slightly hate me for even mentioning that possibility, then you understand James 4. James uses the word in verse 4, you adulterous people. God has made us for an exclusive relationship with him. God has made us for a relationship of love and joy and friendship. He is 100% devoted to us. And yet so often, we are so disloyal to him. The whole of human history is a story of humanity cheating on God, rejecting his love, rejecting his generosity, and choosing to follow after other competing loves. That's the story of humanity, right from the Garden of Eden, throughout the story of Israel, right down to you and I today. Because really, how loyal have we been to our God? 50%? 25%? 10%, if that? How much room in our hearts do we leave for him? A small corner. Often, and so much of our mind, so much of our heart is taken up with the world instead. And James just wants to press this home to us. If you are a Christian trying to be a friend of God and a friend of the world, you might as well be saying, God, I love you, but I don't want to be loyal to you. James hits us with this knockout punch. We are flirting with the world. We are cheating on God. This is why sin is so bad. Sin isn't just about breaking God's rules. Sin is breaking God's heart. That's what James is saying in verse 5. You may have a slightly different translation. Think that scripture says without reason that he jealously longs for the spirit he has caused to dwell in us. What God is saying is, what James is saying is that God has given us life. He has put his spirit in us, given us life, whether that's the life of actual physical existence or the new life of becoming a Christian. And he jealously longs to be in relationship with us. And when we become friends of the world, it hurts him. It cuts deep into the bone. It costs God when we reject him. Sin doesn't just break God's rules. It breaks God's heart.